Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast, a podcast channel here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. More importantly, I have the pleasure today of inviting back to the podcast Dr. Uta Huskin, who is head of the Department of Cultural and Religious History of South Asia at the South Asia Institute at Heidelberg University. Welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you, Raj. I'm glad to be back.
Yeah, it's my delight. As you can tell, I'm delighted by a number of books, but it is a true delight to be speaking today about a collected volume of essays called Laughter, Creativity, and Perseverance, and subtitle, Female Agency in Buddhism and Hinduism. Very exciting stuff. Tell us a bit about the genesis, the backstory of this project.
Well, I mean, like so many of my projects, it is a collaborative, the outcome of a collaborative endeavor. And for whatever reason, I think I have always, throughout my academic career, worked on gender issues of sorts, very often not being aware of it. But at some point, I realized that there's something going on right now in these traditions, at least in those traditions that I know of within Hinduism and Buddhism, that seems to be, well, at least from some perspectives, a radical change, meaning that there are more and more female actors who occupy positions of religious or ritual leadership that they have been excluded from before. And of course, I mean, the few case studies I know of are just only a few. So I was actually originally planning to apply for a big project. And in the context of preparing for this project, I convened a workshop in Heidelberg, so at Heidelberg University, and I was inviting a few women and men who are working on similar issues. And it was very important for me at that point also to invite a number of junior researchers, because most exciting work is actually coming from the young people, and I'm now, as a senior scholar, I can say that. So we had a wonderful workshop. Over 3 days, we were giving presentation, we're discussing. And I feel that at that workshop, it was especially the connections we were able to establish, let's say, behind the scenes, were of special importance, because there was a sense of collegiality and sharing that was really extraordinary. And I do think that the last chapter in this volume, which is authored by Carolyn Starkey, and which talks about methods and, problems sometimes researching issues that are connected to female agency in religious traditions that actually speaks of this spirit, because Carolyn also continued the discussion with all of the researchers afterwards. And we were talking about our research processes, the disappointments, but also, of course, the small victories that we had. And that was basically facilitated by this really very collegial spirit during this workshop. I also think that this workshop, and also I think we had one panel in 2019 then at the AAR in San Antonio, some of us at least had, that is why at least I feel that the different contributions to this volume are really, they speak to each other and they address topics from different angles. So I'm really happy about it, this volume.
Yeah, we touched on this aspect during your last podcast, which had a similar paradigm of a fruitful workshop, and really it really is an admirable MO in terms of, at least to my mind, you know, holding space for scholarly community, and seeing what happens with the cross pollinations and the conversations, and they're always more than the sum of their parts, and then invariably you have either let's share this, right? Let's publish this, or let's do something with this. I mean, that's how we first came in touch with your brilliant bringing together of people interested in Navaratri, and I really think it's useful for scholars to. There may be some among us who take that for granted as a fruitful avenue, but also to really foreground, you know, bringing people together and seeing what happens. I had the good fortune of attending a symposium, I think it was in Toronto, where I'm based at the University of Toronto. It was Srila Taraman that put together this phenomenal lineup of speakers on, it was a Vaikuntha topics really.
Yeah, that's right.
I couldn't resist, because I just happened to be guest lecturing at the U of T and I saw the poster. You know what? Let me sign up. I've got to come, so that the magic then happens, right? And you could tell by the last luncheon, everyone was engrossed in conversations about, oh, who will do this part of the volume, or what should we do now, or how, you know, and it really, really is magical. So thank you for holding that space for so many of us and for the fruits of that labor. So more on the fruit of this labor. How is, you know, feel free to say a word about that last chapter. I think it'd be a great thing to touch on, perhaps since you mentioned it, in terms of, female agency in Buddhism and Hinduism. And the subtitle is Methodological Reflections and Collective Commitments. Maybe say a bit of a word on that last chapter, that is the only chapter in the fourth section, and then maybe we could talk about the structure of the sections of the book.
Yeah, sure. So this last chapter, as you rightly say, is the only chapter in this fourth section. But I do think it's a very important chapter for the book as such, because in this, Carolyn Starkey reflects together with the contributors to the volume on our own position and attitudes in the field. How, for example, especially when women are researching on women's issues, how our political stances would, or can at least, impact our research. And this was a her chapter is a result of a continuing conversation with the different contributors over months, I would say. So there's also this kind of tricky question whether we as researchers actually understand agency in relation to Buddhist and Hindu traditions similar to the people we are looking at, or who we are working with, who are we doing research on. And what happens when we suddenly realize that our own political commitments might be very different from the ones that the people we are working on are? So, and feminism is here a big word, a big trigger word, the F word that no one dares to speak about, because it especially when, at least that's my experience, when you work with women in religious settings, this is very often perceived as some kind of aggressive Western stance of claiming rights and so on. And so many of us said that we actually avoid this term altogether in order to in order to be able to do our research. At the same time, I do think that many of us do have what I would call a feminist attitude, but I would also say that many of the people we're working on are have a feminist attitude, even though they themselves would not use the term. So all these conflicts while doing research, difficulties, and also, I mean, basically the necessity, which is very fruitful in the end, to question your own commitment, your own attitude, and maybe come out of this research process as a different person. So, yeah, that is all addressed by Carolyn. And I do think that this is a chapter which might be especially useful for young researchers who are looking for some kind of not guarded, but open guidance and an open presentation of problems you might encounter when you're doing research like that.
Well, I found it to be exceptionally rich, and because, you know, one could easily derive insights for all kinds of conversations and fieldwork, and the categories that we use and the commitments that are implied in our particular, you know, genders or stances or even subjects. And I found it fascinating. You know, I have not heard it referred to as the F word before. Well, that's, I may use that at some point. But I have said to people that in certain contexts, I'll avoid myth because it's a four-letter word for a lot of people.
So it's your N word.
Yeah, exactly. It's a four-letter word. And what I find especially fascinating is this issue with categories and discourse. And what we do as scholars is, you know, we intellectualize and we adopt categories and we massage categories and just, you know, maybe take a breath even before all that and just see what people are doing and see what they're calling it. And it may well map well onto the categories we use or not, but just get a sense of how they think about what they're doing. And I think that's clearly a rich chapter.
Yes, and this also very often, I mean, I find this especially in Buddhist contexts, that it is somehow very difficult to talk about, let's say, for example, the question of ordination for women in Theravada Buddhism, because on the one hand, there is this idea of the non-self and so on. At the same time, there are women who are demanding something. So how do you bring that together? And how do the women themselves bring that together? I mean, it's very fascinating, but not easy. Not as easy as you would might want.
Indeed. Important work and not easy. And I suppose if this work was easy, this would all be ironed out after decades of scholarship and millennia of religious history. But maybe tell us a bit about the structure, the different sections of the work.
Yeah, we subdivided the contributions, or we found that the contributions address mainly three different domains, and these are, that's what we labeled, renewing religion in female spaces, then appropriation of male spaces, and performing religion publicly. That doesn't mean that the different contributions only address this topic, but that they mainly, I mean, speak to this, to a certain, let's say, range of topics. So in the first section, There is Valeria Gazizova, who writes, her contribution is entitled Exclusion, Secrecy, and the Underground, Dynamics of Female Religious and Ritual Agency in Kalmykia. And that is, I mean, Kalmykia is a republic in southwestern Russia, and it's actually the only region in Europe where Buddhism is in fact historically practiced. And Valeria here looks at the transportation, I would say, of religious transmission from male to female spaces. And this, I mean, this transportation which happened in the Soviet era, and so the Soviet era, which was certainly of very traumatic in many ways, it paradoxically also brought new opportunities for women, who then were able to reposition themselves as religious specialists and also religious leaders. And it's very fascinating how the lower status of women as opposed to that of men in the pre-socialist Kalmykia society, and their actually their exclusion from Buddhist establishment, then allowed them to become important transmitters of religious and ritual knowledge. And that's what is captured with this term underground, because this is, of course, metaphorically used, this word, but it's also literally, because some of the places where religion then in the Soviet era was practiced was, in fact, underground. So that's a very interesting and fascinating case study. I could talk about it very long, because also Valeria is currently right now, she's in Heidelberg as a postdoc researcher with a project. So we are in constant contact on this topic.
Without exaggerating, we easily could have a podcast on each of these contributions. They're fascinating. as you're well aware, they're rich and they're fascinating. And with luck, some of these authors will perhaps appear on the podcast, perhaps to talk about monographs or developments. Yeah. Sure.
Right. Then the second contribution in this Renewing Religion and Female Spaces section is by Ina Ilkamer. And this is entitled, This is Not a Home, It is a Temple, Creative Agency in Navaratri Kolu. And here you can see some overlap with other projects that we, I mean, the Navaratri project that we had for quite a number of years. And Ina has done her research in Kanchipuram, a place where I'm also doing a lot of my research. And she has looked at the transformation of the Kolu practices and has looked at them as practices that are transforming within female spaces, where it was extremely important that now new female actors were taking over. And basically what she has been mainly dealing with is the transfer of the Kolu practice from Brahmin to non-Brahmin actors, and how does that transform what these practices do and mean to the actors, and how where are the continuities, but also where are the changes when suddenly Kolu is practiced in non-Brahmin households. And this is, it's really fascinating, a great piece to read. So I can highly recommend this.
These two contributions that are the two that contribute to this idea of renewing religion in female spaces. Is there a word or two we can say about that overarching concept, or is this perhaps surprising in a sense, or do you want to make a comment about the category?
Well, I would say it's only surprising if you understand agency as connected mainly to resistance and challenging of existing hierarchies. However, if you understand agency as encompassing much more than that, and also understand practices of compliance as agency, and if you look at the look for agency in also small acts of changes, then it is not surprising. So I mean, here we strongly, very, very strongly rely, of course, on the seminal work of Saba Mahmood and also Joanna Cook and others, who have clearly shown that it is extremely important to to turn away from definitions of agency that only understand agency as resistance. And here I would say, especially when you look at those practices that change within female spaces, they can easily be overlooked, but not if you take them seriously. So I think that's tying them together. Yeah.
No, thank you for driving that home for our listeners. That was a beautiful insight. Okay, so section two, what do we have?
Well, that's appropriation of male spaces, and that's, there's, I don't know how many contributions, a few are there, at least three, four.
Yeah.
I didn't count them. So the first contribution here is by Tarini Bedi, and she's writing about body politics and the gendered politics of Hindu militancy, Shiv Sena women, and political agency in Western India. And she writes here about the dashing ladies. So the dashing ladies in Maharashtra who appropriate these traditional male spaces of activity, that is policing and politics. And Tarini's focus is on the women of Shiv Sena. And she shows how agency in this specific nationalist movement is not only the capacity to act, but also, and importantly, the capacity to act with and through the body. And that is what the women themselves label dashing, and which kind of means the capacity to display public anger. So in a wider sense of the word. So that's the first contribution, and that somehow summarizes parts of Tarini's book on the dashing ladies of Shiv Sena, and it really fits very nicely into this section. The next contribution is on the article that's called Buddhist Radicalism, a Vehicle for Female Empowerment, ? And that is by Melin McKay and Iselin Friedenlund. They deal with women who are connected to radical Islamophobic Buddhist organizations in contemporary Myanmar and Sri Lanka. And basically this is, let's say, a contribution that is very early in their research on the topic, and they explore why women would sympathize with such ideologies and why they would participate in these movements. And puzzling is here that these nationalist movements, like so many others, are particularly concerned with controlling the female body and concerned with female reproduction. So Buddhist radical groups, they call for regulation of marriages between Buddhist women and non-Buddhist men, and they call for family planning policies for non-Buddhists, including legal regulation of women's reproductive health. And these laws, interestingly, they enjoy widespread support also among women. And so the question is, what's happening there? Why do women support this? Yeah. And I mean, at least as a preliminary finding, the authors find that through membership and activities within these organizations, it seems that the women who are participating are able to access broader lay networks and monastic networks, which then allows them to operate as, let's say, protectors of Buddhism. And that is, in fact, a role that the religious tradition traditionally reserves for men. So in that sense, that seems to be very helpful for them and seen very positively. So that is one of the contribution which kind of rattles your idea, not only of Buddhism as a people religion, but I think this is, has been debunked long ago, but also, of the role of women within
somewhat provocative or thought-provoking or even paradoxical, that to surrender agency in one domain in order to perhaps bolster agency in another. I mean, it's fascinating, right? And it's data that just absolutely resists a binary approach. It forces you to think, right?
Yeah, definitely. Yes. Then there's another, in this section, there's another contribution on a Buddhist setting that is by Amy Langenberg, and is called Laughing on the Rooftop, Female Buddhist Agency as Local in Lumbini, Nepal. And Amy's daughter actually took the wonderful picture that is on the cover of the book. So I really need to emphasize that. I'm very happy that she was providing this great picture, which so nicely shows what we're talking about. Anyway, Amy, in her contribution, she talks about the Peace Grove Institute, which is a monastic space that is, however, not for men or boys, but for girls. So again, here, this is a space that is traditionally only available to male members of Buddhist communities, but here it is specifically for girls. And what it does, it actually provides a, on the one hand, socially safe space for the girls, and on the other, it allows them to delay marriage and to continue education. This Peace Grove Institute does not exist in isolation, but it's it heavily relies, in fact, on the cooperation also of the girls' mothers, who strongly support this. But at the same time, Amy is able to show how this institute is also a creation of the girls, of the resident girls themselves, so that they are able to shape what is happening and how things are happening in this institution, which, speak of agency of girls and especially agency of children, which is also, I think, a very important topic here. So that's a really fascinating contribution. Then another contribution here is by Shefali More, and she has her article is entitled "Right to Pray," comparing Shani, Shingnapur, and Shabrimala. Shefali, who is a PhD student here in Heidelberg, she here deals with the actual process and the legal proceedings, and also actually with the public repercussions of allowing women to enter Hindu places of worships, which were previously strictly out of their reach. And what she does is she compares this process on the one hand in Shabrimala, in Kerala, and on the other end in Shani Shingnapur, which is a Shani temple in Maharashtra. And she shows how this, depending on the public discourse, but also on the different agents active there, unfolds very differently. So, but interestingly, it is in both cases only the public and the loud challenge by women that actually initiates a public discussion of these bans of women to these places. And what Shefali does in her chapter is that she analyzes the arguments by the authorities of the places of worship. She looks at the arguments used by the women who challenge the regulation. She also highlights the legal complications in these matters, and also what the public discussion does to it, and especially the role of social media in these processes. I mean, at least here in Europe, even, I mean, the Shabrimala case was in the news for several weeks. It was quite interesting because usually such news from India are not that prominently displayed in the standard news. So, yeah, that was that is something that also kind of spilled over to other cultural areas. Yeah, and then the last section is the section on which is entitled Performing Religion Publicly. And here we have the three contributions. Yes, three Correct. Contributions. One is by Priyanka Ramlakhan, entitled Hindu Women and the Gendering of Religious and Ritual Authority in Trinidad. She deals with three Hindu women in Trinidad whose religious activities in very different ways take place in the public. And she highlights actually the trajectories of these two women. One is a pandita, a priestess, and the other one is a nao, that is something like a priest assistant. Both roles are new for women now. And she looks at how this plays out, how it is accepted in public or not accepted in public, how these women are challenged. But at the same time, what she highlights is also how these two women basically understand their role and enact their new role very differently. So, for example, the latter, the priest assistant, is she is from a rural area of Trinidad, and she is not only the priest assistant, but she's also a ritual expert and healer who basically can read a local mud volcano goddess, who is called Balka Devi. And much of her authority and acceptance within the community and beyond the community really comes from this close connection to the goddess Balka Devi, rather than from her being a priest's assistant. I know close to nothing about Hindu religiosity in the Caribbean. So for me, this is an extremely interesting case study. The next section, that's my own article. I am writing here, I entitled the contribution Tradition, Innovation and Resistance, Training Girls in Sanskrit and Vedic Rituals. And what I look at here is the School for Girls in Varanasi, the Panini Kanya Mahavidyalaya. That is a school for girls that was established in the 70s. And it's in the tradition let's put it like that. On the one hand, their focus in terms of learning is very strongly on Paninian grammar and on Vedic rituals. And at the same time, the girls are also trained in martial arts, in yoga, in music and computer sciences. And what is quite striking, and many of the listeners to this podcast might have seen these girls if they were in Benares, because since 2014, they also publicly perform a Vedic Homa at Asigat and recite Vedic mantras there. And that is they do this as a part of the program Subah e Banaras, this morning in Banaras program that many of you might know. And what I'm looking at is basically what kind of strategies these women and employ to integrate in a tradition that excludes them. So what is the way of argumentation, and how do they understand the text differently from their male counterparts? But then also, yeah, what else is there on their agenda, but also what is on the agenda of those who still until today resist this? And then the last contribution to this section is by Antoinette Elizabeth de Napoli, and it's called "I Will Be the Shankaracharya for Women: Gender, Agency, and a Guru's Quest for Equality in Hinduism." And she explores the strategies of a female religious leader to acquire a space for a women ascetics group among the Akaras during the Kumbh Mela. And she's focusing on Trikal Bhavanta Sarasvati, who is called Mataji. She's also a very public person, so many might actually at least have seen her, who demands gender equality and the inclusion of women in a religious tradition that, again, has traditionally excluded women and also low caste from leadership roles. And this woman, Mataji, she actually strategically calls herself Svayambhu Shankaracharya, with long R at the end, so female Shankaracharya. So a self-made female Shankaracharya, and understands that very much in contrast to an appointed or an inherited position. So Antoinette shows how she, in interviews, defines herself, how she, on the one hand, aligns with what you could call a strong feminist agenda, on the other hand, also distances herself from that. Yeah, that's basically what we have in this volume.
Rich array of case studies. I mean a wide variety of methods and spaces and traditions within Hinduism and Buddhism. Do you want to maybe say a word about this process for you? I mean, taking the bird's eye view, looking at all these papers, bringing them all together. I mean, you make some insightful remarks, of course, in your introductory contribution, but do you want to share a little bit about what struck you about the volume as a whole, or how this process was for you bringing this together?
Well, what I find quite interesting that it seems to me that if you wanted, you could cast a much wider net, and not only that we restricted ourselves to Hindu and Buddhist traditions is not really called for when you look at the topic. So because you can see similar developments currently in the Catholic Church. I'm not so sure about Jain tradition, but I'm sure there would be some, one would find something. Of course, Muslim traditions are all these, let's say, movements, women assuming positions and claiming spaces for themselves that they haven't been able to, or maybe also in many cases didn't want to claim before, that is something that seems to be happening as we speak. Currently, there will be, in fact, another companion volume to this one. We're working on another volume where we cast the net a bit wider. We stay within traditions that are prevalent in India, and but that also are transcultural in character, and we look at also more into, let's say, historical aspects of that in this second volume. I find it interesting that things seem to be happening right now. But what I find even more interesting is that this, in many cases, also is connected to the fact that men are moving out of these positions. So there is a blank space that needs to be filled. And that gives the women or gives many women the opportunity to fill this space, because, and that is also, I find that if I look at the case studies, that's much more often the case than let's say in Tarini's or in Antoinette's case studies, where the women kind of stand up and say, no, we resist, it should be different, and demand that. But it's more a silent movement that, let's say, a movement or movements that are more often silent than not. That's what I find. But of course, if you look at that, also depends always on the case studies you're looking at.
Mm. Well, one of the metaphors or sort of truths that comes to me in the back of my brain as I read some of these is this this Taoist idea that, you know, people think that, you know, rock is stronger than water, but it's really water that erodes rock over time, the power of yin. And I think Amy Oloko had that's a comment, Amy Oloko had said something on the back. I'll just pick it up and read it, actually. She comments, of course, on the wide-ranging and fine nature of the contributions. And then what she says is, the contributors press us to notice not only spectacular changes and innovations, but also subtle ones, and to appreciate how women may creatively transform tensions into opportunities.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that the title that we chose for the volume really captures it, this very well. So that kind of that tensions are laughed off, and that also tensions are always very often expressed in communal laughter. And that, yeah, there very often is certainly a deep knowledge that resistance might not be as, let's say, as successful as just staying on, sustaining your attitude. And that a lot of creativity is needed to adapt, and which also means at the same time, it is not simply that the women are taking places that were reserved to men before, but they are also massively transforming them, even though many of them would say they don't. But from my perspective, I see also massive transformation that go along with that.
Mm, absolutely. How could they not? I think you're right about that. Well, thank you. Thank you for your efforts to bring together people in conversation for this volume and for so many others. And that wonderful way of being, that's really, I mean, clearly you can tell from the fruits alone, much less probably the enjoyment that people have coming together. That way of being is very productive, that collaborative enterprise. And thank you for your efforts in editing this timely volume.
Thank you very much. But it's a great joy, of course.
A labor of love, I imagine. a labor of love. I've been there.
Okay. Editing is not always a great joy, but yes, getting together with people, listening to people, and listening to different, not only case studies, but also views on these aspects. I mean, I learn most of all.
Right. The podcast aspires after, New Books Network in general aspires after public education. But really what I say, it's really, I'm being educated in public with each author that I speak. Right. And so here we are. It's about my public education, actually. Well, thank you very much for appearing on the podcast today.
Thank you.
For those listening, we have been speaking with Dr. Uta Huskin, who is editor of a fascinating new work called Laughter, Creativity, and Perseverance, brand new 2022 OUP. It's part of the American Academy of Religion, the AAR's Religion, Culture, and History series. Check it out. Keep listening. Keep well. And keep contemplating female agency and agency in general, however gross or subtle that may look. Take care.